This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
We're more or less 1 year out from the election of Donald Trump. And that election continues to raise a lot more questions than answers. Let's put it that way, at least for now. Last week, we saw the first charges come down from the Robert Mueller probe. And from what we gather, we've only seen the start. So I wanted to start with Jeffrey Toobin, who's been watching the investigation very, very closely for us. Jeff is a staff writer at The New Yorker and a legal analyst for CNN. Jeff, I'd like to begin by talking about the election last year, which is very much in the news by way of indictments.
Right.
I want to get a sense from you what you think that Robert Mueller has. I know some of it is conjecture, but where you think his strategy is going when you look at what happened early this week?
David, I also work in cable news, so conjecture is my business. I think in many respects, the most interesting thing that was said all week was something that came out in one of the papers, court papers that was unsealed in the Papadopoulos case, where the prosecutor said, in describing the case to the judge, this is a small part of a much larger investigation, which certainly suggests, unless the prosecutor is completely blowing smoke, which I doubt, that we're going to see a lot more cases. We're going to see more indictments. We're going to see more guilty pleas. And as for where that's going and how, I don't know. But I think, you know, Mueller certainly served notice this week that this is a major investigation that is far from over and may just be beginning.
When you look down the line at this, how vulnerable is the presidency of Donald Trump at this point? I'm not talking about the fates of Michael Flynn or Manafort or some of the others, Carter Page. Donald Trump, how vulnerable is he? What did this week's events indicate to you?
You know, for obvious reasons, I've been doing a lot of reading about Watergate. And one of the things that I think in the historical memory of Watergate doesn't get enough attention is that Richard Nixon, this Republican president, got into trouble when both houses of Congress were in the hands of the Democrats. And, you know, while it wasn't as polarized a partisan environment as it is now, Democrats had no brief for Richard Nixon. So you had Sam Ervin chairing the Watergate Senate Committee. You had Peter Rodino chairing the House Judiciary Committee. What's so different now—
Democrats all.
You're right, is that Trump's own party controls Congress. And I don't see any scenario, with perhaps one exception, where this House of Representatives will impeach Trump for anything. The only conceivable act that might trigger that would be if he fired Mueller, if he had to not only fire Mueller but fire Justice Department officials
down the line,
who refused to fire Mueller, and then he fired Mueller. Other than that, anything related to the Russia investigation, anything related to obstruction of justice in connection with the firing of James Comey, I don't see any way this House of Representatives votes to impeach him.
The analogy here seems to be not so much Watergate as something you know even more about, but rather Iran-Contra, which had all kinds of secret machinations. It had hearings and, let's say, less than forthcoming generals and diplomatic back channels. The Reagan administration committed serious crimes, but was not impeached. not put in such serious jeopardy of its existence? It seems a little bit more.
I think that's a closer analogy. I think maybe this is because when I was one of the prosecutors in the Oliver North case, I like to remember that as a bigger victory than perhaps it was. And Reagan was damaged politically. I mean, he did not the Iran-Contra case basically went from late 86 to through 88, the end of Reagan's second term, and he didn't get much done in those 2 years.
So, Jeff, if your best guess is that so long as the House of Representatives is safely Republican, Trump is pretty safe from impeachment, what are the odds and what has to happen in order for the House to turn Democratic?
Well, you have to have close to a political earthquake for the Democrats to pick up the number of seats that they need.
Like actual competitive elections.
Right. And the reason why that is so unlikely is because the congressional districts are gerrymandered to such a degree that the out party has very little chance of winning seats that the majority party holds.
Right. And the issue of gerrymandering is before the Supreme Court in a case called Gill versus Whitford, the big Wisconsin redistricting case. So what's at the core of this case and what's it all about? How does that affect things?
Well, this is, I think, the most important Supreme Court case in decades. And what it comes down to is this. Every 10 years following the census, state legislatures draw the lines for the House of Representatives federally and the state legislative bodies. Technology now exists so that the party in charge can draw lines with such precision that they could basically guarantee that certain seats will go to certain parties, that they can eliminate the possibility of competitive elections, and the party in power can protect their majority with exquisite precision.
But gerrymandering itself has been brought to the Supreme Court before, and how has the court historically dealt with the issue, and what do you expect to be the outcome here? Is Justice Kennedy yet again on the brink?
Even more than most cases, Kennedy is really holds the outcome because there is very little doubt, and I was at the oral argument of it. Four justices basically said, this is politics as usual. We should not get involved. Four justices said, we think this is just an outrageous, undemocratic process.
That's the liberal wing.
That's the liberal wing. And Kennedy, in the earlier gerrymandering cases, has said in effect, look, I don't think the case before us is one that requires the Supreme Court to get involved. But if it gets bad enough, I think the Supreme Court should get involved. So basically
it's a matter of degree then.
It's a matter of degree.
So when Chief Justice Roberts
right.
refers to sociological gobbledygook, what's he talking about?
Well, he's raising the hardest question for the plaintiffs in that case, which is, okay, you say this partisan gerrymandering is unacceptable. What's acceptable? We have to have the legislatures draw the lines. That's their job. What's the standard? What are they supposed to use? And this is a big problem for the plaintiffs. The plaintiffs have proposed some mathematical formulas, which are not exceptionally complicated, but the Supreme Court is made up of mostly liberal arts majors, as far as I can tell, and they don't know. They look at, oh, it's a Greek letter. I don't know what that means. And so this is a big problem for the plaintiffs in that case.
How are things – why is it more of a mess now than it was then?
Because of technology.
It's just the power of computers
but that's a
more precise carving up of the
right.
turkey.
Right. And as Paul Smith, the lawyers for the plaintiffs, pointed out, it's gotten considerably more sophisticated since 2010, the last time there was a census. So if the Supreme Court doesn't intervene – In this case, after 2020, the gerrymandering problem is going to be worse than ever.
So I understand why gerrymandering keeps people in power and works to the benefit of the majority party.
Correct.
How is it responsible also to any degree to the horrible state of politics that we have?
Because when there are no competitive elections between the parties in most districts, congressional districts, state legislative districts, the only thing that incumbents have to fear is primaries. from more extreme versions of their own parties. There is no incentive to compromise with the opposition party because you're not worried about losing the election to the opposition party. You're only worried about protecting your flank in your own party. And there is no doubt that all of this gerrymandering is responsible, at least in significant part, for the extreme polarization of state of legislative bodies.
And that flies in the face of what the framers intended, which was to reflect the changing moods of the country. In the not-so-distant past, how many seats would be competitive or change hands in an average election year as opposed to now?
Well, I mean, in the past, you could have 60 or 70 seats up for grabs out of the 435 in the House of Representatives.
And now how many might we see?
20 would be a lot.
20 out of the whole House being competitive.
Well, I mean, it's 20 switching hands would be a lot. It's virtually inconceivable that this that even in a landslide midterm election that many seats will switch, particularly because, you know, the 2010 election, which was such a disaster for the Democrats, and many important states, Florida, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, became entirely controlled by Republicans. So they have drawn the lines for the last 10 years in those at least theoretically competitive states that has locked in the Republican advantages in those seats.
So are Republicans better at this than Democrats, or it's just that they've been winning lately and therefore been able to take care of what you're describing as the technological revolution?
I think it's a combination of things. They are
and money's involved.
They're better at it. They have more money. They're also, as you go back, particularly in the 1990 and the 1980 census, Republicans made alliances with African American politicians who wanted extreme incumbent protection. So what happened was in many states, especially in the South, Georgia, for example, the Republicans who were in control of the process said to the African American politicians, "We're going to give you super, super safe seats." So all the black voters, thus all the Democratic voters, were in a handful of seats where the incumbents won with 90% of the vote. But that meant that all the rest of the seats were drained of Democratic votes. So what you see throughout the South now is you have a handful of African-American Democrats and almost everyone else in the legislature is a white Republican. So that figures into this as well.
So over and over again during the campaign in 2016, Donald Trump would talk about how the whole thing is rigged. After the election, and I think with greater reason, the defeated Democratic candidate would talk about cheating vis-a-vis Russia or fake news or all the other mechanisms. And yet nobody before or after the election on any great national level, on the expert level, yes, but on any great, you know, public outcry was talking about gerrymandering. Why hasn't this gotten more attention? Is it too technical?
It's complicated. And it's difficult to explain in a way that will motivate voters. It's also it doesn't have a simple solution. I mean, you know, the biggest way to address it is through the courts. And, you know, you don't mobilize voters by saying, you know, we're going to file a lawsuit under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. I mean, it's just not something that motivates people.
So let's say Anthony Kennedy goes the way of the liberal wing of the court. What's going to change?
It's actually quite simple. What would happen is what currently happens in two states, Iowa and California, where the parties name independent commissions that are relatively neutral experts, and they draw the lines. And Iowa in particular, as a result of this, has very competitive congressional elections. California at the moment doesn't particularly because there are just no Republicans left in the state. You can't, you know, gerrymander people who don't live in the state into the state.
Right.
But Iowa, you know, has a really good system. And I think more states will be more or less compelled to use these commissions.
But Kennedy has to vote that way.
Kennedy has to vote that way.
And if he doesn't?
If he doesn't, it's The outcome of the 2020 elections will be even more enormously important because the opposition parties will jam the losing party even more than the Republicans did in 2011.
I have
now,
to ask
Democrat,
you.
Well, but Democrats also have a better – have a somewhat better chance than they did because they are looking better in the midterm elections of 2018. So they could elect governors of Michigan, Ohio, Florida that will give them a seat at the table in 2021, which they didn't have in 2011.
I have to close with a kind of general question. We're living at a moment when we're recognizing foreign interference in our democratic processes. We've just discussed gerrymandering and how that's distorted democracy. We're about to have a conversation about voter suppression, which a lot of people are very concerned about, and you've written about so well for The New Yorker. One could be really pessimistic about the state of democracy and democratic processes with real reason in 2017, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's one thing to have, you know, changes in policy when you know, one party comes in, the other party comes out. I don't think anyone feels there is anything undemocratic about that. But when you start to have the rules of the game change, you know, the rudiments of democracy, you know, who gets to vote, whether their vote counts, how difficult it is to register, whether your vote counts in a district or you're districted in so that your vote essentially doesn't count. Those sorts of changes really do go to the legitimacy of the whole system.
And,
that's scary.
And yet we have people, including the President of the United States, who think the biggest problem we have is voter fraud. And in just a minute, we're going to be looking very hard at that issue, too. Jeff, it's very good to talk to you as always. Thanks so much.
Thanks, David.
Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer for The New Yorker and a legal analyst for CNN. You can read him on the Supreme Court's redistricting case, Gill versus Whitford, at newyorkerradio.org. And that decision will be announced probably next summer at the end of the court's term.